Welcome to our podcast From the Ground Up, where we interview startup founders exploring their journeys, their success, challenges, and lessons learned. We hope you'll be inspired in discovering what it takes to build a thriving startup. I'm your host, Jake Aaron Villarreal, and excited to have with us today, Emery Baran, founder of Servos, who's raised $11 million in funding. Emery, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So a little bit about Emery. He launched Servos in 2021 with a mission to make roles and permissions simpler to implement and manage so developers can focus on building their core products. Before Servos, he co-founded Turkey's largest social network at the time, worked for Google, where he built products that generated over $1 billion in revenue, and is a serial entrepreneur. Emery, there's a lot here in your background, and you're maybe more unique than other guests we have on the show, because you've got a background of companies that you've launched, have had a lot of success, worked for Google, which a lot of people haven't. And so there's a lot to just curiosity about what those experiences were like. But before we really dive in here, walk us through a little bit about you, where you're from, where you're at, and how did you get into technology?
Sure. I grew up in Turkey. And then went to school, went to university in the States, and most undergrads, I was an undecided major. And by the time I had to declare a major, I had enough economics classes under my belt. And I did two internships at investment banks. And then eventually I decided that banking wasn't for me. And I even found myself doing more coding and building macros while I was doing my banking job that I decided to go back to school and also to major in computer science. Since then, I've worked in all those companies. And ultimately, I fell in love with technology because it's all about, you know, using machines to do repetitive or even things that humans can't do. So that's how my journey started. That's how I got sucked into technology.
That's great. You know, when you talk about social networks, to us today, it's a very normal conversation to think you're part of a social network, you've been on one, your friends are there. But in the early days when they didn't exist, what inspired you to even think about trying to create a social network, and how did it come about?
So let's be honest. I mean, we didn't invent social networks. And back then there was, this was around circa 2002, 2003, when, digital cameras were coming up, people were putting their photos on, everybody was getting an email address, etc. And back then there was like a couple of, you know, social networks slowly emerging in the US, namely Friendster and MySpace. And my brother and I looked at this, and my brother, I mean, all credit to him. He can spot a lot of things that will have exponential growth from a mile away. And he said, this is going to be huge. And these are all very US-centric, a lot of US people. Let's go build the social network for Europe. We grew up in Turkey. We had a lot of friends there. We grew up traveling all around Europe as well. It's like, let's go build one. And so ultimately, we built a social network and we launched it with 300 of our high school friends. And that was a Christmas. I remember so distinctly Christmas 2002 to 2003. And we launched it with 300 of our friends. And suddenly by the end of February, we had 20,000 users. By the end of the year, we had 500,000. In about 2-3 years, we had 7-8 million users. It was one of those things that, you know, being at the right time, at the right place at the right time, and not just being lucky, but also identifying an opportunity and embarking and actually building it. From a technology perspective, it was also very challenging. These were the times back in 2003. There is very limited open source. I mean, we built Yonja with MySQL, Tomcat, and Apache, and a lot of duct tape. Yeah. And there were no, you know, AWS or Google Cloud providers. We had to actually order servers every week into a data center and hook them up. And even our, you know, it's a fun story. Our very first server was a server that we bought that was living in my brother's living room under the table. And as we started running out of bandwidth and everything else. We're like, we need much more bandwidth than this because it's slow. And we took that server, desktop server, to a data center, literally turned it sideways, put it on a rack, and hooked it up to like a high bandwidth connection. And that was our, you know, very beginning of that journey. But it was about, you know, seeing that potential of how we can connect people, how we can, you know, get people to be more online and be, you know, present themselves online and share more of their experiences with their friends.
Yeah, it's, you know, so prevalent today, but back then, even to be thinking about how you could put that together, was your brother also an engineer?
He studied industrial engineering. He thinks he can code, but God bless him, he can't. I mean, he can build very basic things, but it was, you know, mostly it was me and a couple other engineers who actually initially built it. And then a lot of our challenges was around actually scaling that. And, you know, this thing became the most traffic thing in Turkey. And, you know, only right next to it was like Yahoo Mail at the time and a little bit of eBay and like the one major news site. So there was a lot of lessons learned on how to scale open source, how to scale all these things. And, you know, we were doing MySQL replication before MySQL replication was a thing. We were doing load balancing, software-based load balancing before that was a thing, and like experimenting with a lot of software. So, you know, he had an engineering background. My brother had a vision, but a lot of the things was, he was much more focused on the product management and the CEO job where, you know, we had to also generate revenue for this thing. And back then nobody was nobody pays for social network, right? The ads and various other things pay for it. And our audience being mostly in Turkey, we had to actually manage a business in Turkey for all the advertising and et cetera revenue from US. And, you know, we had our initial, he was instrumental in building that initial team, the sales team and the customer service team. And then, you know, I took on a lot of the engineering challenges.
When you try and scale a company, you have to go somewhere to learn how to scale. You got to get involved in other people that know how to scale. What was your path to learning how to scale a product or a company?
So it was, so as you said, there are two different distinct things here, scaling a company and scaling a product. So in terms of scaling a company, you know, Yonca, at least back then, it wasn't that big of a company, right? Three of us started it, and at peak, we were about 20 people. And by the time we got acquired, maybe 25 people, mostly on customer service. And so there wasn't that much of a challenge there. The bigger challenge, actually, of Yonca was around scaling the product. It's, you know, this, you know, prototype site, website built on very simple, you know, Apache Tomcat and JSP templates. How do you actually handle 8, 10, 12,000 people concurrently being online? So there was a lot of Googling, a lot of learning, a lot of talking to other, you know, back then there were a couple of forums that had similar levels of traffic, and pretty much Yahoo and eBay. There were, you know, there weren't that many frameworks, that weren't that many things. So a lot of it was trial and error and trying, you know, building systems that will potentially scale. So then my journey was ultimately a lot of that scaling was learned at Google. So I, you know, I hit a fork in my career where, you know, while I was doing Yonca, I'd also applied to a business school. And I got into business school, but I had to defer that because the company was growing very fast. And then eventually I had to go to business school. And luckily, that was like a 1 year, very intensive business school called INSEAD, based out of France and Singapore. And I spent a lot of my days during the week going, you know, going to school, and in the evenings actually working. And at the end of the business school, the goal was for me to go back, right? There was like, we had a fast growing business. But in the meantime, Google came to the campus, and that was like one of the very few jobs that I was excited. I was like, oh, that can be an interesting company. Like, I didn't want to do, you know, consulting or business, investment banking and various other things. So I'd actually applied to Google, and then I got recruited into Google. So I came to this fork where, you know, I could go back to my own company and keep growing that, or go to Google and learn real scaling, because Google was, you know, back by then, this is 2005, 2006, a global powerhouse, and they had, you know, huge traffic. They had, sort of, you know, 90 to 100% of search traffic in a lot of companies. And my brother and I, we decided that it would be best for me to go to Google and learn real scaling in terms of a product. And, you know, spend a year or two there and then come back and apply a lot of those learnings. So about a year into my journey at Google, Yonja got acquired. So then I actually continued at Google. And where I actually really learned what it takes to, scale a product technology-wise, which I actually applied a lot of them in my next company, but also learned about how to operate a very large scale organization. And to this day, credit to Google, I don't know, back then when I left Google, it was about 15, 20,000 employees, but it was light years ahead of any other company of that size. So a lot of my learnings from Google, we applied it at Qubit, where we actual learning of my how to scale a company happened, because, you know, we were three of my colleagues from Google, and I actually moved to London at that stage. Started Qubit. I was the only technical co-founder. I built the product and engineering team, and that company grew from four people to, at its peak, about 320. And that learning journey was full of mistakes, and that's, I think, how you learn how to scale a company. You have to, you know, fall into a lot of those traps and make a lot of mistakes and learn by that. And luckily, towards the, you know, mid to late in my journey, a lot of podcasts started becoming also very popular. And nowadays, a lot of my learning is, you know, listening to a lot of other people's journeys. And thanks to podcasts like you and other ones, we get exposed to those things. Because back in the day, it was all about, you were lucky if somebody actually wrote a book and published about it.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned a couple of things I just want to go back to, and we'll come back to your Qubit company. But with your social network, you mentioned you got acquired. How did that happen? Because I think the dream for a lot of startup founders is you build a product, you find the market, you get funded, you scale it, and then you get acquired and you retire. Like, in your first company that you started, got acquired, I think it's amazing. Whether the numbers were big or not doesn't really matter. Just the fact there was enough value that someone would want it, that's incredible. Yeah. And maybe the numbers were huge, but walk us through how that happened.
So I think the key thing there was we were actually the number one market leader in Turkey. There were, at the time, there were many other social networks that actually started, but we were the ones that actually grew fastest and had the market share. So that helps a lot, because at the end of the day, social network is a B2C product, and popularity drives a lot of B2C products. And as long as you have a decent product that people like to use, and you haven't taken many wrong steps, you know, people draw other people in, and that's the nature of social networks. People want to be where other people are. People want to find their old friends. People want to hang out with new friends. People want to see a lot of stories shared. So number one, the product on its own was a great magnet to actually draw everybody. Second one is, it was a great business, because it wasn't only an ads business. And we also actually generated revenue from Prime membership. And one of the story behind that is, you know, at early days, we built Yonja. We had very little angel investment from one investor, but that gave us the confidence to go forward. And at some point, with all this computing costs and services, servers, etc., we had to find some sort of funding. Right, because it had to pay for itself. Every day we weren't paying ourselves any salary, or like minimal salary for insurance and various other things. But there was a lot of server costs. Every week we ordered like 4, 5, 6, 10 new servers so that we could actually handle the traffic, handle pictures and everything else. So there were two options. Number one is a good old method of advertising, right? So talking to publishers. At the end of the day, it's a it's a, you know, huge audience, a lot of eyeballs, and a lot of, you know, great eyeballs for, by advertising standards, like a lot of young people, you know, young professionals who are in the beginning, they were, you know, prime candidates for a lot of CPG companies, etc. So we actually started putting ads and monetizing the traffic through that. The other thing that we did that none of the social networks nowadays do, maybe, you know, Elon Musk is trying to do this a little bit with his Twitter check marks, was we actually took a look at our traffic. We took a look at what people do when they come to Yonja. And what we actually suddenly discovered that a lot of our traffic was about, I think 48% or so was actually people browsing pictures. And then right after that, people actually messaging and look, and what actually resulted from a lot of these things are people actually dating. Because as a social network, one of the key things that you can actually see whenever you're talking to somebody new, how you're connected. Like, how do you know that person? Are you connected to that person? Are you a first degree connection, second degree, a third degree? Which it turns out is a great validation if when people want to actually date somebody, they don't want to date a complete stranger. They want to actually date somebody that's somewhat known to them, etc. Anyway, by looking at all those traffic trends, we actually decided to draw a line between what is social networking and what's dating. And back then, there are a lot of, you know, there were the eHarmonies and various other companies that were actually great. They were making a lot of revenue from that. So by drawing that line, we actually said, okay, here's a fine line. If you want to send, I believe it was 15 messages or 10 messages. If you want to send more than 10 messages a day to different people, that's, you know, now you're actually going out of social networking per day into, you know, dating. If you're browsing more than 100 pictures a day, again, you're leaving the realm of social networking into dating. And then I don't remember now, it's been 20 years almost. But there were a couple of other, you know, boundaries that we found. And we said, if you want to do any of these things, now you got to become a, we used to call it the golden member. And the golden membership was about $3 to $4 a month. And through that, we also generated a lot of revenue. So at the end of the day, the path to acquisition was we had a viable business that was generating not only revenue, but profit. We had a business that had a lot of eyeballs and a lot of people spending time on it. On average, I believe per day, there was like 48 minutes or 52 minutes, something like that, spent on our social network. And the realization moment for me was one day, you know, when I walked into a florist to get, I think, my grandmother some flowers. And in the background, the guy who was working there was on the computer. He said, hold on a second. He did something and then came. And then I immediately recognized our interface. I'm like, oh my God, the florist is on it. All right. So all of these things aligned up. And at the end of the day, our acquisition of Yonja was by the largest Turkish ISP and their private equity investors. So they're ultimately, it was a bit of a consolidation game for them in terms of the total, you know, internet monetization traffic in Turkey.
Wow. I love that story. And I know that a lot of people don't know behind the scenes how things go down. So to hear it, it sounds like you understood the analytics, you looked at the patterns, you understood there's an opportunity and you had the right people around you to want to take it on or acquire it. Let's switch gears to Quibit, the company that you raised $75 million. You scaled it to 300 and downsized it. This is happening in today's market prevalently from like big companies that we know about to smaller companies. And the lessons that are learned, I'm sure, very instrumental in just how it shapes you as a leader, but also what you can take from that to your next company or companies in the future. Walk us through what were some of the biggest lessons in that downsize that you went through that you recall as being really incredibly important today?
So I would say, I mean, the Quibit story is pretty much the story of my 30s to early 40s. And there's a lot of me, my personal development actually that was aligned to that company as well, right? So we, four of us starting in a room, a company, and then actually growing and discovering a lot of things along the way. And we were lucky enough to again, we identified a trend. So first of all, before we actually started the company, and that was the big data revolution back in 2010, Hadoop became open source, and a lot of data that was kind of available, but not processed or used. And that's one thing that we identified coming out of Google, you know, the hotbed of data and data-driven decisions, that we tried to make it available to all these companies. And of course, because of that, Qubit grew very fast, very quickly, right? So there was four of us in 2010, and about 2016, by the time we raised our last Series C, 40 million, after that, we actually reached about 320 people. And the lesson learned there was that we actually grew too quick, too fast before we actually realize our product market fit. And it turns out you can have a product market fit in one market and you may completely not have another product market fit in another market. So it turns out that, you know, we actually operated in the UK, mostly in the UK market. Qubit was a market leader. When you walk in Main Street, which is the high street in the UK, 90% of the brands that you see on the UK high street were our customers. Their e-commerce businesses were our customers. We understood really well how those e-commerce businesses operate, and it worked, because in the UK back then, there was a good mix of what companies looked for, which is a good mix of professional services and technology, right? A lot of companies not only buy technology from you, they want actually your professional services, your advice, and various other things. However, when we actually looked, when we tried to expand in the US market, you know, we slowly started losing our product market fit because a lot of companies were looking for self-service and they didn't want professional services. And throughout our journey, a lot of the times when we were lacking something in product, we always tried to make it up with professional services, and nobody minded that in the UK. But in the US, suddenly you're starting to lose trust between the company and the customer, and they actually start questioning it, which eventually leads into a churn. So, and we thought we had the product market fit in the US, and we scaled US up very fast, which in turn ate a lot of our funding, and suddenly we started spending way more in customer acquisition costs than we would get in a lifetime value from a customer, which, you know, it's a great way of learning why investors care about that ratio. And eventually that led to us, you know, growing the company, having all the operations, all the sales and everything else ready, and to pour a little bit of fuel on the fire. Our average customer acquisition time was between 6 months to 9 months, right? Or sometimes up to a year. So that means you need to actually make that much of an investment before you can see a dime from a customer. And now imagine you're doing all of this with a huge sales team, sales and marketing and operations team on the ground. And suddenly all of those customers that you're spending more than 1 year of revenue to acquire, they're not renewing their contracts. And suddenly you find yourself in the hole. And that was the journey, right? So that cascaded across the company. And there was a bit of a failure of our product management. There was a little bit of failure of our sales and marketing in terms of strategy, not seeing the signals upright and trying to compensate that with, you know, throwing more, you know, bodies at a problem, whereas, you know, we should have actually taken the earlier step to stop all of that, fix the product and get there. And throughout that, you know, downside, once you actually hire all these people and then you realize the writing is on the wall, you know, the goal is to save the company, survive so that we can actually live another day to fight. And that led to, of course, some hard decisions to, you know, start shutting offices down, start downsizing and various other things. And from my perspective, when I was actually running the engineering team and running the product team, etc., the biggest learning was around, as a company is growing and scaling, we're adding more bodies. And every time you add a new body, it's actually you're hiring, you know, when you start a startup, you hire a lot of generalists because you got to cover so many different areas. And then as you actually grow, now you don't need as many generalists. You need to start getting specialists for every single area. However, the biggest challenge is as the tide starts turning, so now you have a lot of specialists in the company and you're downsizing, but you know, ultimately you're maintaining some people in the company, but those specialists now need to become generalists again because they can't just do one job or they can't just focus on one area. We need to be able to go back to that startup mindset where everybody needs to do everything. So that has been a great learning around, you know, and a challenge when it comes to downsizing.
Yeah, that's I love how you explain that. I went through a similar scenario where we had a company and we took a product and brought it to market and we invested way more in the people than actually the revenue coming in. And we were upside down for a long time until we had to start making those hard decisions. It's not just a business decision, it's an emotional one too. Because they're real people that you've built relationships with and you have to say, you've done a great job. Unfortunately, it's not working out right now. And so I think you get battle tested emotionally as well, not just educated. You know, there's like, you know, business is 80% psychological. So if you're in tune with how that works, you can weather the ups and downs, but there's an emotional aspect to it. I think that I'm no founders and everyone goes through and they understand it, but you don't always understand it until you have those hard decisions to make.
So I'll give you a tip on how I coped with that. So first of all, you're absolutely right. When you have to go through that, it's a business decision. And for some people whose first job or the only job they've known or a job that they've, you know, they've grown up with is this, it's very hard to separate that emotional connection from a business connection and actually to be leaving a company. However, there have been people that we had to let go, and it's always hard, right? It's because each one of those employees also have friends staying. So there's still a connection to those people. It's not like you're never going to see them again. One way that I coped with, and I actually mentioned this to someone, and it's a bit controversial, but I always thought about it this way. Unfortunately, you know, it's when it's a business decision, you have to make it happen. But when we think about that business decision, you know, when somebody actually, as a manager, you know, I employed probably more than 300 people within my team over the tight period of 10 years, and you know, some people came, some people quit, some people would let go, various other things. But at the end of the day, I was always at the receiving end of somebody, you know, I always knew when somebody on a Monday morning at 8 a.m. put a meeting in the afternoon, it's like, you know what's going to happen. They're going to come and leave, right? And in the U.S., it's employment at will. In the U.K., usually people have a one-month notice. So they actually tell you that they're about to leave. So the way that I coped with it is like, hey, like when we actually let people go, now the entire equation is reversed, right? We didn't let them go right away on that day. We're actually giving them their 1 month notice. So at the end of the day, it's a bit of a, you know, karma in a sense that it's a balance, right? And just like you can leave, I can let you go as well, but it's all on the same terms, right? We give each other a month of notice. That's enough time to get each other ready for it. You know, probably this happened to me way many more times than number of people actually we had to let go. So, you know, once I was able to logically think about that, I came to like better terms with it. But hopefully that might actually be helpful to all those listeners who actually have to go through a similar journey.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to have an impact on some people for sure. What was the outcome of the company once you downsized and got into survival mode and then re-innovated? What was the exit?
It eventually got acquired. So we actually went through these trials and tribulations, I believe, twice. But at the end of the day, it was acquired by an e-commerce personalization, e-commerce merchandising company, because it was actually a good complement for their business.
I went through a similar scenario like that, and it's always good to know that you had enough value built in where it ends up in good hands, and you know, you get something out of it too. Maybe the lessons are the most important part you got out of it, but you know, you see it through and you kind of grow from it.
I think the most important lesson there is, again, it's the company's survival, right? It's the technology that you built. As long as the technology you built or the product you built has value as a business, there's always somewhere it can actually plug into. And again, from a personal perspective as a founder, et cetera, the success story is always different, right? So there are some, we always hear about the $1 billion exits or, you know, and those make the news, but not many of those just regular exits where a company gets acquired by somebody else so that it can survive and actually its technology survives, its teams actually continue building it, doesn't make the headlines that long, that much.
Yeah, I hear you. Let's dive in now to Cerberos, your current company. And I'm going to just read through a little bit of content here, and you can correct me if it's off. But we really read about you in TechCrunch, and we read the article, it was bringing your product to the cloud. And kind of the content reads as Cerberos exists in a space broadly known as Identity and Access Management, IAM. A $13.4 billion market that's expected to double in the next 5 years. Your product at its core is about decoupling authorization process from an application's main code base, making it easier to scale their access management system. This is particularly important as companies transition from monolithic software to microservices. Correct me if that's accurate or if it's not. And if it's not accurate, let me hear you. And if it is, let's dive into what inspired you to build it.
It is accurate. And if I may summarize it in one word, in one sentence, Cerberos ultimately makes implementation of roles and permissions very easy. It enables so that developers don't have to build all of that logic into their code, scale, and make it extensible. And what led us to build this company was that we had to actually go and build authorization layers multiple times in our careers as a founding team. And every time we had to build it, we had to spend, you know, a month here, 2 months there, 3 months there with an engineering team of 3 to 4 people so that our product can have roles and permissions built in it. And when you think about that, it's a bit crazy, because a lot of times when you're building software, a lot of the infrastructure that you need nowadays is available off the shelf, right? A lot of people, going back to the Yonja days, we had to actually get the servers, physically hook them up, put operating systems and get it all going. And nowadays, nobody does that. Nowadays, you actually just, go on Amazon one click or go to Google Cloud one click, you have servers available to you. And similar thing is actually now when you look at the software stack that you're building, there are frameworks that are readily available, so you don't have to actually think about how to handle your HTTP calls, your APIs, or there are authenticate providers available, so you don't have to do your own username and password storage and lookups and all the security bells and whistles around it. There are services that do all of your email sending, your payment processing, your SMS sending, your various other infrastructure pieces that you take it for granted that you build on your software on top of. However, authorization is still not available off the shelf at the same quality as all these other services are. And when that happens, good engineering teams actually need to build something in there that will actually stand the test of time as their companies grow. And I had to build that at Yonja so that, you can think of Yonja as a customer, as a social network, but it had a whole another department in the back office, which is around customer service, right? Handling spam, abuse. We had those gold membership that you had to actually handle payments. And suddenly you have an office, bunch of people in different roles that you need to control who can do what, who can restore an account, who can refund a payment, who can, change an account status or look into investigate a report. So we had to build roles and permissions there. Similarly, at Qubit, very similar story where, when we started our product, we actually just built a very quick and dirty authorization layer where, everybody was either a super user or a read-only user, or you had no access. Suddenly, now we were doing actually professional services on behalf of our customers. So then our customer service team had to actually assume some of these roles. And then suddenly we started getting customers with, you know, 1,000 users or hundreds of users within their organization that need to be able to do these things, but they don't want everybody to have same rights. So there's governance that plays into this. So we had to actually go and build that authorization layer 2-3 different times based on all of our customers' requirements. So, and every time you build that, it means the engineering team that's building that infrastructure, that layer, is not focusing on a real customer requirement in order to make your software better. You're actually going back and building infrastructure. And we saw that in the market. Ultimately, you know, authorization and in the IAM space, authentication is handled, right? In the IAM space, directories are handled since 1980s. There's LDAP, which was decoupled. It started with, now there's Microsoft Azure Directory, Cognito, and various other directory services. And the security space and IAM, there's logs, log management, and all the action logs, etc. is handled, but there's still not a single solution that's actually reliably handling authorization. And we ultimately set our course on solving that challenge.
So if you're a software company or an engineer that's building a platform and you want to embed your solution into their product, how long does it take to do that?
It's always with software development, it's like, how long is a piece of string? But that being said, it's ultimately, you know, for a very normal RBAC, which is role-based access control, or ABAC, it takes, you know, 5 to 10 minutes to be able to implement this. And then you get, in return, you get an API that you can actually connect to from anywhere on your stack, where you can actually check the permissions of whether a user is able to do an action on a resource or not. So I would say, you know, 5 to 10 minutes to get started, you get to have your very basic implementation. And depending on how complex it gets down the road, you can actually, you know, it may take a bit longer.
Sounds like the real benefit is not just having that as part of their platform without having to build that in their infrastructure, but also time. Like, it saves them Absolutely. A ton of time of having to build this, which is money. And also maybe you lose out on market share if you're trying to get to market with your own product. So that to me sounds like an incredible solution for anybody that's building technology or software. When you went to get funding for your company, what was that like? And we asked this question because for founders that haven't raised capital yet, it's a double-edged sword. You go out and raise the money, you give up part of your company to do it, and the pressure is on to build, get to market, and hopefully have success before the money runs out. So there's pressure from the investors to actually do something, execute, and grow. But when you went out and got funding for this, what was the process like? How many times did you have to pitch before you got the funding? And then how much pressure is on you now from your investors to actually make this work?
So we were slightly lucky because we actually went to market around March 2021, which was COVID times, which was a lot of VCs were taking a lot of calls. But I also capitalized on that. So let's get the story straight. Before we actually went on to funding, we built a product. We built a prototype. We had we had probably about 120 interviews with potential customers in different companies. You know, here's the idea we have. We're thinking about this. Like, what are your needs? How would you implement this? And various other things. So the product, that prototype that we've built, was built on top of our experience with having to deal with this and potential customers and what they're looking for. At that point, we had a prototype that customers and investors can actually take a look at, and we had a demo that we can actually show. And after the demo, it wasn't a smoke and mirrors. We could actually leave the product behind because it was kind of open source that they can actually play with. So on the back of that, prior to going out and doing a proper funding round, I actually did couple of calls with friends who now happen to be VCs. And I was only soliciting feedback around, hey, what do you think about this product? What are the, you know, what do you think this has a shot? Where do you think this fits best? And suddenly I started getting interest from those friends, right? Friends who are VCs, they're saying, hey, this is interesting. This plays in this space, this plays in the security space, which is a true horizontal when it comes to in software. And suddenly, as I started seeing the interest there, I suddenly realized, hey, this is actually a very big opportunity, which, you know, initially in my mind, I'm like, okay, it's a good business. It's a good layer of software that a lot of people think. But, you know, going back to, as you quantified this IAM space, I wasn't fully aware of the market size there. Once, you know, I became aware of that, then I grasped the whole, you know, the potential there. And then me and my co-founder decided to actually, number one, form a company, because now this is going to get real. Is this something we want to do long term? And yes, the answer was yes. And the second thing was, now this is where COVID kind of helped us and accelerated. I was willing to talk to any VC who wanted to talk to me. And I ended up talking to 89 different VCs. And I still have that sheet here. And again, this was our luck at the COVID times. A lot of VCs were doing a lot of calls, and a lot of these calls were actually on video conference, right? And so, I opened up my calendar from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. So that covered pretty much all of Europe, Eastern, you know, Asia, and all of the US. And yeah, I spoke to 89 different VCs. Some were interested, some were not. But as you know, I tried to narrow down the process and started putting time pressure, etc. And so, they were both VCs and angels, or like large check angels. I had 19 terms at the end of the day, so which became a problem. It's a great problem to have, don't get me wrong, right? But it's a problem because now 19 people are saying yes to you, and you need to choose the right ones. Like, how do we actually, you know, there's no way you can have 19 investors on your cap table, because also when it comes to VCs, they want to put a significant amount of cash because they need to justify the returns and the process. So, you know, just to, you know, answer your question, going back, is like the pressure was on me to, number one, to pick the right set that would actually understand this business, so that later on, you know, I can have a healthy relationship with them where, you know, when they put a pressure on me, we're actually all on the same page. So that's when a lot of, you know, again, analytics kicked in, looking at all these investors, like, what are they good at? Which one of them actually understands a SaaS business? Which one understands an open source business? Which one understands a developer tool? Because every single one of these have different dimensions that impact your business model. And you know what you don't want is the wrong VC trying to push you for growth or for different, you know, pressure you for different angles that are not right for our business type. So at the end of the day, we chose, you know, what some classified as a party round. But the way that I looked at this is it takes a village to start a company, and I wanted to have the best support village around me in order to get this company going. So, you know, chose a VC who understands developer tools as our lead investor, chose a VC who's very good at SaaS businesses, chose a VC that has a lot of, two VCs actually, that have a very large portfolios of startups, which are our potential customers for us, potential initial customers. A VC that understands open source software and open source licensing. A VC that, you know, that's geographically great, that, you know, it's connected to a lot of our next stage investors. somebody that, what else? I'm sorry, like there's so many VCs, but at the end of the day, those were the dimensions. And when I looked at all the terms, I'm like, okay, here are the ones that we're going to go with. And suddenly, you know, when you look at it, there are a couple of very well knowns that are actually sitting in one category. And unfortunately, you have to say no to some of them. And, you know, I had, you know, I broke some hearts, and I was actually feeling really bad about it as well, because I'm like, it would have been amazing to work with them, but I can't have two of the VCs with the same value proposition sitting on the cap table.
I never knew that you actually can, you should turn away investors that, you know, that could potentially help you grow a business. I guess if you have enough investors to choose from, then you have a good problem to
It was a great COVID problem. I mean, just to reflect back to my Yonja fundraising and Qubit fundraising rounds that we've done. I mean, we just, you know, in my career, we just finished last March. We just closed. I just did my 10th round with investors, right? And it is, you know, up till that round, it was only one term sheets. And maybe when we had two term sheets, I'm like, ooh, we have a competitive situation here. Whereas with Cerberus, when we did our first seed, you know, suddenly, it's very weird to say this, but suddenly money wasn't an object anymore. It was like money was commoditized because everybody was, you know, giving terms, very favorable terms. And we didn't actually go and take the highest terms either, because at the end of the day, you need to think about this as like what happens in the next round, how much do you need to grow to cover that? And there's a, you know, fallout if you.
Yeah, the patterns that we're seeing are very similar to what you go through, which is when you get investors to give you money for whatever startup you have, what's the trade-off? What do they give you as well? You know, do they have a big network they can introduce your product to? Do they have connections to a strategic industry that you don't? So I think it's important to also look at what do they bring aside from the money? Because the money's there, but what can they do to help you build or scale the company? I want to go back to one thing you talked about before you even brought the product to the table to get funding, which was you had roughly 100 or 120 meetings or conversations with companies or people that might be interested in your product. You left it behind. They tried it. You know, as a company that's just starting out, you know, I'm sure a lot of founders wish they had a network that they could have 120 meetings with, or presentations, or demos, or sales pitches. How do you even start to get that volume of companies you're going to present a new idea or product to?
I mean, it always starts with people you know, right? Because those are the warmest introductions. Those are the people who are willing to take a minute from their job and listen to your pitch and evaluate. But of course, not all of them were people actually we knew. But you know, when you start thinking about that, it's almost going back to my social networking background, right? There's a first round of circle around you, and then the people that people know, and then the people that people know. So the classic thing was, after talking to my contacts, I'm like, who else do you know who might be interested in this? Who else have you worked with? So start tapping into their network. And similarly, which I think worked on our favor really well, as I was talking to investors, one of the things that I was always, the VCs, one of the things that I was always testing is like, hey, who in your portfolio can we talk to? Which served us in two ways. Number one, we got an introduction to a brand new company that we can get actually feedback from. Number two, we always knew that feedback would make it back to the VC, which kind of, you know, strengthened our case. So it was a lot of networking that, in that sense, but always, you know, keeping to warm connection or warm connections.
I love that.
And at some point, actually, I also remember we've done a round on, I believe we use user interviews or something where, you know, I wanted also like a non-biased, like, feedback from the out cold, and we actually spoke to about 10 different companies or 10 different people from different companies that we recruited and got their feedback as well.
Really important. So Cerberus, we've talked a lot about the company where you're at today. How big are you now as a company, and where is the company located? It's distributed remote, correct?
Correct. We are legally in the UK, a UK company, but we are distributed across, I don't know how many time zones anywhere. We are anywhere between, you know, New Zealand, Philippines, Turkey, Serbia, Bosnia, UK, Portugal, Maryland. I'm sure I'm leaving a country out somewhere in there.
Very international. How Very big international. Is the employee?
So we are about 12 full-time employees, and then we also have additional team members that are working with us part-time. And this is actually is one of those other decisions that we made. Like, not everybody has to be full-time, right? Not every function has to be full-time. So we actually leverage a lot of professionals in different, you know, on a contractor basis, but we also treat them as just full members of our company. We have, you know, everybody's engaged with them on Slack conversations. But, you know, if you ask where the company is running on Slack asynchronously and fully remote.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that about part-time, or we call it fractional workers today, where there's just a huge demand for, I need the work done. I need it done at a high level, but I also don't need to spend a full-time salary for somebody, at least at some point in your company. Eventually you grow it to a point where maybe you do, but you know, our business, we pivoted a little bit too. And a large amount of our work today is companies that are bringing on fractional or part-time workers in a contract basis, you know, globally. And it's been
one more dimension to add there is job done right by senior and experienced people. So we actually pay a lot of attention to that, which is when, you know, when we get somebody fractional, it's great. I've done this for years at Qubit. We had a very great triangle where we actually brought up, you know, people who didn't have much experience and brought them up. But when we're operating in an environment when there is no office and there's no learning by osmosis, we actually don't have that time or capacity to be able to train people as much as you could do in a physical office. So that's why it's very important to have senior and experienced people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, 100% agree. If somebody wants to learn about Cerberus, where do they find you? And if they want to connect with you directly, where would they connect with you?
So Cerberus is cerberus.dev, our website, or you can just Google Cerberus. I believe by now we've won the SEO games everywhere in the world. It just comes up as the first result. I am on both Twitter and LinkedIn. On Twitter, I'm Emre, E-M-R-E, and on LinkedIn, I'm Emre Baran.
Great. Emre, is there anything before we wrap up that I haven't asked you that you want to share?
I mean, in many dimensions, if you let me talk, I'll talk till tomorrow morning. But I guess the key thing is for entrepreneurs who are listening to us, for people who want to build software, I would have one piece of advice, which is build something that you're passionate about. Because it's a roller coaster ride. There'll be good days, there'll be bad days. And on those bad days, one thing you need is, you know, encouragement to keep you going. And a lot of that comes from passion to solve a problem, passion to serve customers, passion to deliver a technology to improve life, to improve the world. And if you are only doing it for commercial success, but nothing else, sometimes that runs out. So focus on what you're passionate about bringing to the world.
I love that. Well, on that note, I want to thank you and give a big shout out to Emre for taking his time today and sharing all these valuable lessons to our listeners. And to our listeners, thanks for joining us. It means the world to me as we continue to go through these episodes and learn. I'm your host, Jake Aaron Villarreal, signing off, but can't wait to connect with you again on the next episode. Until then, sayonara. Before we wrap up, I want to give a big shout out to all the entrepreneurs that have joined to make this podcast possible. And for all the listeners for listening, it means the world to me that you chose to spend your time with us today. I'm your host, Jake Aaron Villarreal, signing off for now, but can't wait to connect with you all soon on the next episode. Take care. This show is sponsored by Match Relevant, a company that helps venture-backed startups find the best people in the market, and they do it in three simple steps. First, they sit down with founders to understand their story. Second, they tell their story into multiple candidate channels. And third, they schedule interviews within 48 hours. Find us at matchrelevant.com to learn more about how we do it.